Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Andrew R. Murphy about his biography about the 17th century English Quaker and founder of the American Colony of Pennsylvania, entitled William Penn, A Life. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to join us today. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'd be happy to. Probably most relevant or germane to our conversation today is that I was born and raised outside of Philadelphia. Familiar with the iconic image of William Penn, everything from the statue on top of Philadelphia City Hall to the image all over the place. Penn was someone who I had sort of a general familiarity with as someone who grew up in Pennsylvania. I went off and did my undergraduate work at the University of North Carolina and then went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, studying political science. And I was particularly interested in the history of political ideas, more specifically the history of the idea of religious freedom and where it came from and how it emerged both in Europe and then in America. So William Penn played a bit part in my doctoral dissertation, which was my first book called Conscience and Community. And from there, I had teaching positions at Villanova, at the University of Chicago, at Valparaiso University in Indiana, and then since 2008 at Rutgers. I continue to be interested in these sort of connections between religion and politics and the history of both of those things in America. I wrote a book called Prodigal Nation, which was about the rhetoric of moral decline and divine punishment. But I kept having this kind of interest in the back of my mind about Penn. He's a figure I referred to in another piece I wrote as someone who's everyone's heard of. But actually, a lot of people don't know much about him. And it struck me that he was sort of an underappreciated figure in the history of political theory, which was my academic field. So I came back around to him because it struck me that what was one of the things that was really noteworthy about Penn was that he was not only a political theorist, but also someone who tried to put political ideas into action. So I've been interested in sort of the interconnections between religion and politics and the history of our political ideas. And those are the kinds of things I teach and write about.
And you've written about it in a previous book about William Penn that was more a study of his ideas. What led you to undertake a, you know, cradle to grave biography of the man?
Well, that's a question I asked myself a few times when I was in the middle of microfilm and working through his papers. As I said a few minutes ago, Penn is someone whose name is ubiquitous. And yet what I quickly came to realize that in the history of political theory and in the history of the development of religious freedom, the big name that most scholars go to is John Locke, who was a famous Enlightenment thinker, wrote the letter concerning toleration in 1690. And Locke was very influential on the American founders, and he gets a lot of press in the history of religious freedom. But it struck me that Penn was someone, not only did he have a very famous name, but also he was someone who not only theorized about religious freedom and offered arguments and reasons about why it was a policy that ought to be pursued, but he also had the opportunity to attempt to actually create a society where that value would be embodied in the institutions. So it was a life that was not simply a life of political theory. It was a life that was deeply enmeshed in political practice, both in England and America. And it struck me that 2018, just the year that's just wrapped up, was the 300th anniversary of Penn's death. And so as I was working through these various projects earlier in the 2010s, it struck me that this gave me a kind of time frame to work within. And I would say also, a lot of the existing biographies struck me as less than satisfactory. A number of them were written in ways that sort of highlighted Penn's Quakerism, which was, of course, an important part of his identity, but it was one part among many. His role as a founder of an American colony was one part of his identity, but it was one part among many. And so I really thought that the time was right for sort of a re-investigation of this life that always struck me as enormously complicated, filled with unbelievable achievements, but also deep, deep disappointments. And so I found myself again and again sort of coming back to this idea. And now here we sit.
That point you made about the biographies, I think, is a very interesting one, because when I was doing some background in preparation for our conversation, I was looking at some of the previous biographies that had been written about him. And it was fascinating to see how, say, 70 years ago or so, you have all these small biographies about him, the ones that are geared towards, say, middle school students, mm-hmm. you know, the typical biography, you know, young boy makes good, you know, here's our, you know, capital F founding, capital F father, right. and so forth. And how then, you know, you still have biographies written about him up to the present day, but there doesn't seem to be as much about him as there was, say, 2-3 generations ago, when he seemed to be much more of a touchstone of our nation's past. Do you think that we've maybe bypassed him in some ways in terms of how we like to reference him to our own past? Or did those books just simply do such a good job at the time that we didn't need anything for a while and now we do? I mean, it's just that vacuum just is so interesting.
It is interesting. I think one of the things that happened was that a major publishing project put on first by the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, which a sort of scholarly team in the mid 1970s, Penn's papers were kind of gathered and cataloged and published on 14 reels of microfilm. That was sort of in the mid 1970s. Throughout the 1980s, a team of scholars sort of selected some of the what you might call the greatest hits from those 14 reels, and they were published by University of Pennsylvania Press in four print volumes, four big thick print volumes, which you can still find today. And so there's a certain amount of materials which are sort of newly accessible. They always existed, of course, but they were just not quite as easy to get a hold of. And so there's been, you know, a kind of new opportunity then since the late 80s and into the 90s to go back and sort of re-engage with him. I do think, or at least I like to hope, that the 2018 anniversary and its approach was something that sort of made the audience for this book that we're talking about today sort of a reality. But one of the things that's really interesting about Penn, and I have sort of an unscientific quiz that I often ask friends and colleagues. I say to them, you know, Penn became the proprietor of Pennsylvania when he was 37 years old, and he lived till he was 74. So he had 37 years, more or less, in charge of this colony. If you were to guess how much time he spent in England versus America, what would you guess? And the answers are just really surprising, because the right answer is 4 years out of 37. But a lot of people said to me, well, I thought he was born here, or I thought he spent all of his time here. And so to get back to something I said earlier, his name is ubiquitous. His sort of his figure, his image is ubiquitous. And yet he was someone who during his own lifetime was absent. And his relationship with his colonists was, you know, very stormy. And so despite the fact that he is on the one hand this very familiar figure, he's also quite mysterious and remains unknown.
And that to me is surprising after having read your book, because you describe, I mean, you think, you know, in some ways we tend to sort of treat these, you know, figures of the of the past as being kind of these dull lives and so forth, especially when you're talking about sometimes people who have, you know, contributed so many ideas, we assume that it was kind of a rather stale life of the mind. And yet, as you recount in your biography, he lived this very dramatic life. He's imprisoned repeatedly, sometimes for debt, as you open with the book, but also he's imprisoned for because of his beliefs and his practices. And he had these very dramatic set pieces in a couple of instances, which shows that it's a life that is, you know, very much full of activity and I would argue still considerable relevance.
It is. It's a remarkable, and that may be another answer to your earlier question, which I didn't quite. As I studied his thought and the book Liberty, Conscience, and Toleration, which I wrote a couple of years ago, was a study of his political thought, the published contributions to the political theory of his time. But as I studied that life, it sort of dawned on me that this is not someone who's just an interesting thinker. This is someone who is all over the place in sort of the history of his nation, in the history of Quakerism, which is sort of growing and having sort of growing pains at that time, in the history of transatlantic English and American relations, in colonialism and the English Empire. He's got connections to Ireland, and as I said a minute ago, there are, you know, sort of soaring accomplishments and there are crushing disappointments. He is both a sort of a high-minded utopian visionary. He's also someone who is quick to take offense, and he holds grudges, and he's bad with his money. And so I had not ever written a biography before. I know some of your guests you have on are sort of biographers by trade. It wasn't something I ever particularly planned on doing, but I thought this is a fantastic story. And to be able to sort of tell that story and hopefully reach a slightly broader audience than some of the more academic work I've done was really exciting to me.
One of the things that made it so fascinating for me was the journey that he undertakes in his early years. And I was wondering if you could start off our examination of his life by explaining William Penn's background, his origins, and his early years, because it was really that in contrast to that later life he has as a Quaker and a proprietor that really, I think, for me, started highlighting just how dramatic that life was.
Yes, it's a fantastic and a fascinating story. His father, later Admiral and later Sir William Penn, was a naval commander, very successful one, fought on the parliamentary side in the English Civil War, which was during the 1640s, right when Penn was born. His mother was a Dutch who came to England via Ireland, widowed. Her first husband died in religious violence. And so both of these very interesting people sort of formed the backdrop for young William Penn. It's worth pointing out that we know very, very little about the details of the early years of his life. If you were to go and look at those 14 reels of microfilm I mentioned, the first document is William Penn's baptismal certificate, October 1644. Second document is his entry certificate into Oxford University. So there's this gigantic sort of void in the primary source data. Now you go back and sort of backfill some of that, and you do learn that there's a bit more going on. Of course, his mother relocates him out of London as a young boy, likely concerned for his health. It was a notoriously dirty and disease-ridden city. So they move out to a little town called Chigwell, which is about 10 miles outside London. You can get there on the London Underground still today, and you can still see the school that he attended. It's been in continuous operation since 1629. It's there that he has his first kind of religious vision, has a sense of himself as somehow in touch with God. There's a sort of pastoral, bucolic setting there, which is then brought to a quick halt when his father gets thrown into the Tower of London by Oliver Cromwell. He goes from being Cromwell's favorite commander to being a pariah. And when he finally is released from jail, takes the family to his lands in Ireland, which he was granted by Cromwell. So he goes to this little town called Macroom, which is outside of Cork, Ireland, spends 4 years there. We know, again, very little about anything that really happened there, except we do know that while he's there, probably at the age of 13 or 14, he has his first encounter with Quakerism in the form of a traveling preacher called Thomas Lowe. He spends 4 years in what must have been a really remote seeming, going from the greater London area to just out 30 miles outside of Cork, Ireland in the 1650s I suspect would be a pretty significant culture shock. From there, he goes back to Oxford, which was the Christchurch College, Oxford, which is really a training ground for the English elite, which is what his father's got in mind for him. His father has risen through the ranks of the Navy and has aspirations that his son will follow in some sort of public service career. Oxford doesn't work out too well for him. He's, as we've been mentioning, a deeply religious, deeply pious young man. He's kicked out of Oxford after just a couple of years. His father sends him to Europe. There's a chapter in the book called Young Man on the Move, which really is about the first half of the 1660s, where he's in France, spends a little bit of time at the Protestant Academy after being kicked out of college, comes back, decides he wants to study law, but then the Great Plague hits London, so they close down the law school. And it's really, he's really a bit at his wit's end, but you can see from the sort of story I've been telling you, there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of emotional turmoil, and there's a lot of sort of uncertainty about where all this is going to lead this young man.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was thinking as I was reading those chapters, that this restless searching that's taking place. He is looking for something. He doesn't quite seem to know what it is, but and the breadth of his journey is what makes it so impressive, because you're talking about a person who, in the context of the mid-17th century, is traveling to Ireland, traveling to Germany, traveling to France, a person who is really, seems to be hunting for something and he doesn't necessarily seem to know what it is.
I think that's right. I think he is, by all accounts from his early years, a deeply sensitive, spiritual, pious, religious young man. This, in sort of a negative direction, this alienates him from the established Church of England, which is built on, as you might know, a lot of ceremony, intricate theology, rituals, and so on. And he's got this kind of spiritual yearning. But he hasn't really found, at the point that we're at in our conversation, hasn't really found it. And what really cinches it for him, his father sends him to Ireland to negotiate. I mean, they were English. This is a part of the story that as an American of Irish heritage is something painful, the story of England and Ireland. But they are basically part of the colonizing elite. They are living on land that had been expropriated from the native Irish, to which they are then entitled rent payments. So Sir William, who is back now working with the restored monarchy and the Navy, is preparing for the war with the Dutch. So he's too occupied. He can't attend to the Irish affairs himself. So he sends his son in 1666. So he'd be in his early 20s to go to Ireland to negotiate with the new with the tenants, to sort of settle the land claims, which are always a bit ambiguous and up in the air. And it's on that trip that he encounters Thomas Lowe again, the same Quaker. It's a great story. The same Quaker preacher whom he heard a decade earlier in Macroom, he encounters him again. And it's at this point when He feels that all of this spiritual striving, searching, questioning, ambivalence and alienation. When Lowe begins to speak, he says, "I was deeply touched," and he began to weep. And it's at that point that he begins this, what will be a lifelong association with the Quakers, the Society of Friends.
I was wondering if you could provide a bit of context here and explain who the Quakers were in the context of the 17th century and why Penn's association with them is so notable.
Sure. And when his father discovers that he's taken up with the Quakers, he's deeply disappointed, mortified, horrified, angry, summons him home. But Quakers begin in the 1640s, during this time period I was mentioning earlier, the Civil Wars, with the breakdown of the central government and sort of the upheavals that come along with such kinds of events. A number of religious groups arise that are sort of disaffected from the established church. And the Quakers begin under the direction of an individual named George Fox, who recounts in his diary that all the different ways in which he was alienated from the religious options that were out there, and that finally he gathers around him, you know, groups of believers, and rather than engage in sort of intricate liturgical forms with clergy and hierarchies of various kinds, they come to the position that there is something of God in each one of us, and that the appropriate way to worship is to sit in silence and to wait until the Spirit moves one to offer some sort of testimony or speaking sort of a word from one's soul. And so this is deeply offensive to people who think that clergy have a sort of particularly privileged insight into theological things, that you need some sort of formal education, like a university degree, to be a priest. That there are some sort of religious doctrines. The Church of England at this time has 39 articles of its sort of theological foundation. So it's an attempt to strip away all of that. And it's worth pointing out too that religion and politics in this time are deeply deeply connected. So when Penn becomes a Quaker, when Penn in this Cork meeting house in 1667 sometime becomes a Quaker, he not only makes what we would say as a religious conversion, but he's making a major social and political statement at the same time. He's removing himself from the kind of career path that his father had foreseen for him, primarily because one of the key sort of principles of Quakerism at this time was that all human beings are equal, and that therefore all the kinds of elaborate systems of showing deference to your quote-unquote social superiors, like taking your hat off in the presence of judges, for example, or the king, or speaking to them in some sort of elaborate way, all of these things need to be stripped aside. And so Quakers refuse to, as I said, doff their hats to their superiors. They refuse to swear oaths, which is sort of the requirement if you want to hold public office or attend a university. So it's a radical, radical group, despised not only by, say, the Anglicans and other official religion adherents, but also by lots of other religious dissenters too, who see them as dangerous radicals. And so this is one of the key parts of the book is the rift that opens up between Penn and his father. And it's real, and it continues for a number of years, though they do eventually have a reconciliation.
There's also this fascinating tension that's at play as you describe it, because what you describe about Quakers, you know, is something that you detail how Penn embraces it and seeks to live it. And yet at the same time, a lot of what you describe as in terms of who he is as a Quaker and his achievements are because he's not so, like someone you might think of today who, say, renounces the family fortune and divests himself from it and wears, you know, sackcloth and goes off and lives in a monastery. Right. He remains very much of that 17th century English world. And that is so important to so many of his achievements in his prominence.
Right, exactly, and it was not uncontroversial. He was a controversial figure within the Quaker movement because he came from a very distinctive class background. He was in some ways an ideal convert for them. He quickly became one of their most famous spokespersons, writing defenses of them. He was able to publish. He had money. He could get things published. He was, by all accounts, sort of an articulate, charismatic preacher. But he wasn't your average average demographic of what you might expect of a Quaker at this point. And in fact, he was still his father's oldest son, and therefore the heir apparent. His father threatened him with being thrown from the will. But didn't actually follow through on that threat. So when his father dies in late 1670, Penn then becomes the owner of tens of thousands of acres in Ireland. He also inherits a debt that his father was owed. His father had loaned money to the king for supplying the navy, and it's that debt 10 years later that he parlays as sort of leverage. To get his land in America. He tells the king, well, you owe my father this money, but we can forget that debt if you'll give me this land in America. So you're right. He is, on the one hand, shut out of social advancement of the sort that would lead to kind of his father's vision for him. So in other words, he can't take an oath, so he can't serve in Parliament. It's very difficult to advance in, certainly not going to advance in the church, which is the other, another way you would advance in that time. And so because of a number of these features of Quakerism, he's prevented from becoming the kind of public figure that his father had dreamed of. And that's really all his father can see at the beginning when this is first happening. It's a very, very conflict-ridden several months and even the next couple of years. But that said, he then rises within this burgeoning movement, Quakerism, which is undergoing a kind of movement toward respectability and organization and so on. And he plays a key role in this and then again becomes in some ways the kind of public figure that his father might have dreamed of, though his father didn't live to see it.
One of the interesting things about that is the fact that as I was reading your book, was seeing how he never shirked controversy. And I was wondering if you could perhaps talk a bit about some of those early writings and the events that occasioned him. I was thinking particularly about that trial that he undergoes in London.
Oh, sure.
Which to me is one of my favorite parts of your book, where you have this confrontation with the judge. And it really is, I think, the starkest delineation of that conflict between Quaker values and the sort of the traditional Anglican English social order, and how it plays out in the context of a jury, and how you're really seeing the effect of it all, you know, unfolding.
The trial is spectacular, and the title of the chapter in the book is Celebrity, because this is really the point at which he becomes the kind of celebrity that he then remains for much of the rest of his life. He's arrested there's a law called the Conventicles Act, which shuts down all of the unauthorized religious meeting houses. And because the Quaker meeting house is shut down, they end up meeting in the street outside of it. And so he and William Meade, who's another Quaker there with him, are arrested in August of 1670 for disturbing the peace and creating a riot. It's a fantastic story. And it's made even more so by the fact that Quakers, like many religious dissenters, are very savvy about their message and about getting their message out. And so to fast forward just a minute and say at the end of the trial, an anonymously published transcript, and I'm putting quotes around transcript here, appears, called The People's Ancient and Just Liberties Asserted. Now, we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that this is an actual transcript. No one knows what happened, really. But it reads like a courtroom drama in which Penn and his fellow defendant Mead are in the role of heroically standing up for English liberties. And the judge, who's also the mayor of London, Starling is his name, is put in the worst possible light as a power hungry would be tyrant. And so Penn and Mead are put on trial. There are various skirmishes going on, but they get the best lines. They get the lines that cite Magna Carta. They get the lines that denounce the persecutory tendencies of the judge. And finally, the jury is sent out. And at that point in the sort of the development of the jury was expected to do what the judge told them to. It's not the way we necessarily think of juries now. The jury came back in and they first said he was guilty of speaking in the street. And the judge points out correctly that speaking in the street is not a crime, and it's not even what he was accused of. So they send the jury back, and this goes back and forth. And the jury is then sequestered and imprisoned more or less overnight. Penn claims that they were denied, you know, food and a chamber pot. And finally, after six or seven times back and forth with the judge, bringing down verdicts that the judge then refuses to accept, they pronounce him not guilty. And so this transcript that then comes out of it really sort of cements or introduces Penn to a much broader audience, gives him this kind of a persona, sort of a public profile as heroic spokesperson for the jury system, the rights of Englishmen, and so on. It's worth pointing out that even though he's acquitted by the jury, the judge sends him back to jail because they fined him because they wouldn't take their hats off. So we're back again to this sort of Quaker subversion or transgressive sort of quality, which makes it even more sort of poignant is that while Penn is in prison, refusing to pay these fines that have been levied on him for not taking his hat off for the judge, his father is near death, just 10 miles away. And Penn initially says, we can't allow anyone to pay these fines because it would be, you know, it's a violation of my conscience. He does, in fact, allow someone to pay his fine so that he can be with his father. And he is with his father at his father's death. And as he tells the story later, they have quite the reconciliation just before his father's death.
To be clear, that it wasn't the trial that made Penn famous. He'd already published Truth Exalted. He'd already published Sandy Foundation Shaken. He's an emerging figure even before then. And this is the point at which going back to what you're talking about at the beginning of our conversation, this is when he's beginning to make this argument for religious toleration and freedom of thought.
Right. And he's prominent in a number of ways. I mean, his name is the same as his father's, and his father is a very famous naval hero. So the family is sort of well known. And yes, he's been a Quaker for two or three years by the time the trial comes around, and he's had a certain rising profile within the ranks of religious dissenters and so on. What the trial does, I think, is really put a certain political, it sort of catapults him into a number of sort of political conversations and debates that are going on, which really does make him a much more of a sort of a national figure. There's a coalition moving, growing, not simply around religious toleration, but also things like the rights of parliament, the rights of juries as kind of representative institutions designed to frustrate would-be arbitrary tyrants and so on. So and I think also the way in which the transcript sort of presents him really does take it maybe to the next level in terms of him as a figure who then sort of takes center stage in what becomes really a several decades long movement looking for religious and political liberty.
So how does the founding of Pennsylvania fit within that? Is it a point, is he basically balking from the pressure? Is it efforts to take Quakers to a new stage? What leads him to undertake this exercise, and how is it received by the Quakers?
Well, it's right. One of the things that Quakers are insistent about is that persecution and suffering is in some ways the mark of the true church. And so the last thing that any of them would ever suggest would be that Pennsylvania was a place they should go to get away from suffering. In some ways, suffering was something they embraced. In fact, the Quakers eventually publish and they start keeping what they call the Book of Sufferings, which is detailed lists of all the punishments that are meted out to them. So it's not the case that it's simply trying to avoid punishment, but it is, as you pointed out. So if the trial happens in 1670, he gets the charter for Pennsylvania 1681. So we have a kind of decade, 1670s, to talk about. Penn is at this point still rather young, filled with energy, filled with sort of the zeal of the Quaker convert, and also someone who has access to resources. And he is really relentless and tireless in his activities on behalf of Quakerism during that entire decade. Takes two trips to Germany and Holland, one in 1671, one in 1677. Because of his father's connections with the king and the navy, he's able to testify to Parliament and gain access to the king in several occasions to make the case not simply for better treatment for Quakers, but better treatment for religious dissenters more generally. He publishes dozens and dozens of polemical tracts attacking various critics of the Quakers and so on. It's a raucous public sort of atmosphere, and he is fully invested in this. That said, it's also important to point out that his efforts are largely unsuccessful. That there is legislation remains in effect, penalizing Quakers and all non-Anglicans, criminalizing their meetings, fining them for refusal to attend Anglican services, and so on. And the way the political sort of situation is in England, that's not likely to change. Then there's a major crisis known as the Popish Plot. Rumors of Catholic plotting against the king, and that puts all sorts of religious dissenters under the microscope. And so by the time we reach the end of the 1670s, I think Penn's convinced or reluctantly convinced that the situation in England is not going to improve any. And so I think this is a way to sort of think outside the box a bit about what might be possible. Might it be possible to serve God in some other way? And so on. So in some ways, it's a new direction that he comes to. He had had some involvement in the early founding of New Jersey that originated in a kind of dispute between two Quakers, and he was one of the mediators brought in. So he was familiar with sort of the American situation, but that wasn't really a deeply personal founding for him or event for him. So the Pennsylvania founding charter comes about really after a decade in which he was both very prominent as a public figure, but also, I think, very frustrated at sort of the inability to convince Parliament or the king to take a new course in terms of dealing with religious dissenters.
One of the things you do in your description of the establishment of Pennsylvania is you highlight the very interesting contrast between, on the one hand, you have Penn, as you were pointing out at the beginning of the podcast, who having an opportunity to take a lot of his theories and put them into practice, and how this is offset by the reality, which I really thought was fascinating, about when he gets there and he's engaged in the day-to-day operations of the colony, and you have the theory, you have the ideal, and then you have the reality of even when you're breaking in all these Quakers who share a lot of his religious beliefs about how, on a different level, they're ultimately people.
Right, exactly. And you have to have some way of surveying the land and marking off where does one property end and where does one start. And you have to deal with things like, you know, clearing the trees. And he found out when he got over here that, you know, there wasn't as much land as he thought. And he had envisioned Philadelphia being in one place. And it turns out that that wouldn't work. And they had to move it to a different place. And so there's an awful – he has a surveyor by the name of Thomas Holm, who I just found myself deeply sympathetic with because he comes over first. Holm is over here a few months before Penn is. And people are showing up, you know, with their families and their garden hose and their plowing implements. And they're saying, okay, where's my land? And they can't keep up with the press of people. And so there's that issue. And it really is the case that theorizing about religious dissent or popular liberty is one thing, but then actually getting here is another. The related point is that he really wanted control, and he got it. Of what were then called the lower counties, which is the current state of Delaware, because that allowed him a deep water access, which was important for the economic development. That said, these were sort of pre-existing settlements. These weren't all the Quakers coming over. These were Dutch and Finns and Swedes and Germans who had lived there for many years, previously under Dutch control and then to English control. And so that was a very different sort of cultural and political set of communities. And there was a note of discord there from the very beginning. Now, when he gets over here and he does, he has this plan of government and he sends out, you know, notices for the first elections and says, okay, you're going to send us 10 representatives for this body. And the numbers aren't right, but I'm just paraphrasing, and send us four for this body. The people there often say to him, we don't have that many people who we think are qualified to serve in your government. And some of the ones we have, we don't think they're good. So one of the first sort of things that happens is that he sort of shrinks the size of the representative governmental bodies significantly. He had envisioned like a 72 member council and a 200 plus member assembly. He ends up with an 18 member council and an assembly in the 50s. So there's all sorts of very practical complications. And I will say this, while he's there, those first 2 years, 1682 to 4, while he's there on the ground, he's pretty good at sort of managing the conflict. If someone, he'll offer a disgruntled settler who didn't get exactly what he wanted, I can give you some land over here if you'll let me put someone else on this land. There's a lot of that kind of horse trading going on. It's clearly, I suspect, not what he envisioned when he was first thinking about this, but it seems that while he's there, things are pretty well under control. It's when he leaves to go back to England, and maybe we'll talk about that in a minute, that's when things, the alienation really does seem to set in between him and the settlers.
That actually gets to something that I thought came out really well in his later chapters, which was how thin he had spread himself geographically, because in effect, he needs to be in Pennsylvania. He needs to be in London. He needs to be in Ireland. He has all these interests all over the place. And as you describe, he's part of the English elite. He's inherited all his property. And yet you're describing how oftentimes he is, he's desperate for cash. He makes these very magnanimous gestures at the beginning of the colony's establishment. Right. But pretty soon he's having to, basically come, collecting his money because he for all of his property, for all of his prominence, he really is, overcommitted in so many ways.
Absolutely. He, after he leaves Ireland in 1670, just before the trial, which happens just on his return in 1670, he doesn't return there for 28 years. And frankly, if you're an English landowner in Ireland and you don't have someone on the ground collecting your rents for you, you're simply not going to get paid. And then once he leaves Pennsylvania, he's in a legal dispute with Lord Baltimore, his southern neighbor, over the boundary between their two colonies, and they have to go back to London to argue it in front of the Board of Trade. And he envisions this as a relatively brief detour, and he's I'll be right back, in so many words. And he ends up being gone 15 years. And so you simply can't expect that people are going to be volunteering you their pay when they, in many cases, are newly settling in a new place. There's not a lot of currency going around in the colonies, and so there's a whole bunch of reasons why. But he and this is really very quickly becomes a source of deep, deep, bitter frustration at the Pennsylvanians. He pours out in correspondence to them all the sums that he thinks he's owed. You know, the number ranges widely. Comes up with all different numbers, but it becomes a source of deep, deep frustration for him, and really does poison the relationship with his fellow Quakers in Pennsylvania. And frankly, when he comes back the second time, he brings a guy named James Logan with him, who then remains his secretary for life. And Logan, one of Logan's jobs is to be Penn's agent in Pennsylvania, but that's not till later. So he really has very little recourse to make them do much of anything, whether it's paying him the money that he is owed or passing certain legislation and so on. So it becomes very quickly a really fraught relationship.
You've mentioned the boundary dispute that he has with Lord Baltimore. I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a bit upon that and why it was that they had to go all the way back to England to adjudicate it.
Right. Well, what's kind of amusing about a lot of these things is that the maps that they were using in many cases were being drawn and viewed in London, degrees of latitude and so on, often rulings being made by people who had never laid eyes on the place. And so there was this really, really politically charged dispute between him and Baltimore. If the line was where Baltimore said it was, Penn stood to potentially lose Philadelphia. That would fall within Maryland somehow. So it was really kind of a zero sum situation. One of them to win, the other would have to lose. And so Penn said when he first came to America, it's a wonderful letter he writes, and he says, I can see spending the rest of my life here if I can get my family to come over. He said, I'd like to be an adopted American. And yet 2 years later, the Board of Trade and the Crown were the ones who really decided these kinds of questions. So once Baltimore went first and said, I'm going to go back and argue my case in person, Penn then made a very, difficult, but I think probably, unavoidable decision that he had to be there too. It's also the case that Penn had good reason to think that he would emerge successful, not because he was skilled in map reading necessarily, but because his father had been a great friend of the king. And the current Duke of York, who was next in line for succession, James, who later became King James II, had served with Sir William in the Navy. And so as it turned out, Penn was victorious and did prevail in the case against Baltimore. And one of the great what-if questions that I always sort of think about is, what if he had then immediately returned to Pennsylvania and not ended up being gone 15 years? It would likely have turned out rather differently.
And yet he's there at this enormously momentous point in English history, because he is in there in the mid-1680s. Charles II dies. His brother takes over the throne. And his brother, of course, has an agenda that is, not only is he, is he friendly towards Penn, but he has an agenda that actually meshes nicely with a lot of Penn's ideas about toleration and belief.
Exactly. And that's precisely the reason why he doesn't go back to America. Because if you think about it, what is it that drove him into public life in the first place? It was the search for religious liberty for English dissenters. And Penn also, I suspect, was like any of the rest of us, he has a certain vanity to him. The king says to him, I have this vision for a society that English society would embrace its religious dissenters. Penn and James are both alienated from the Church of England. James is a Catholic. Penn is a Quaker. They're both converts, so they have a certain sort of convert type zeal for their faith. And Penn quickly becomes what one scholar has called the intellectual architect of James's sort of campaign to repeal the laws that persecute religious dissenters. And he becomes enormously influential. He walks the halls of power in ways that we have to admit make some Quakers slightly uncomfortable. And it seems as if there's a real opening here. And of course, it all comes crashing down in 1688 when James is able to flee to France and ends up living a fairly comfortable life, although he tries to regain his throne unsuccessfully. But Penn was not so lucky. And there's a great line in an article about Penn. The Glorious Revolution was not glorious for William Penn. It was a time where he was the time after 5 year period after 1688. He's under suspicion. He's called in for questioning. He's imprisoned multiple times as a sort of a loyalist or suspicions of treason. He loses control of the colony for a year and a half or so. His wife Guillaume dies. And so there's a really dark time for him. He insists to the end of his life that James's intentions were good and he was seeking religious freedom. But again, he's under a shadow for quite some time.
So how is it that he's eventually able to emerge from the shadow and get back to America? And what's the condition of the colony like when he arrives?
Right. Well, he eventually gradually works his way back into royal favor by sort of continually protesting his innocence. Some time passes by. He has influential friends who kind of help ease the way back in. He gets remarried. He doesn't get back to Pennsylvania. He goes to Ireland in the summer of 1698 for the first time in nearly three decades. And then late 1698, he finally returns to Pennsylvania. So he's been gone 15 years, he returns in late 1698. He's been gone virtually 15 years. The situation of the colony is they have, without his permission, changed the constitution. They have been governing themselves in their own view, right? More or less ably and adequately. He's no longer the kind of young, energetic, charismatic founder. Now he's sort of someone who's, sort of parachuting back in after such a long absence. And he's also under strict orders from the Board of Trade to crack down on smuggling, and there are reports of smuggling and pirates being harbored, which deprives the crown of their taxes and duties on trade. And so one of his first acts is removing some very popular public officials from office. And so it's really a complicated, tense couple of years where he's trying desperately to kind of right the ship from his own perspective. But the colonists have been governing themselves for more than a decade, and they're not really eager to have him back on the, many of them aren't really eager to have him back on the scene.
So he is there in the colonies for over 2 years, and you've expressed how he had this desire to make that his life, and yet he leaves in 1701 and never returns. What is it that brings him back to England, and what is it that in effect keeps him in England for the rest of his life?
Sure. Well, there's a bill introduced in Parliament which would consolidate all of the colonies under the direct rule of the Crown. So as it stands, he's what we call a proprietor. And so Pennsylvania is, in a sense, his property, and he has certain property rights, just as any other piece of property. One of the rights written into the colonial charter is he gets to appoint the governor. Now, when he's there himself, he is the governor as well. And when he's off the scene, he appoints a deputy. But there's a move, and lots of other colonies are brought under the direct rule of the crown. So there's a a move afoot to sort of consolidate that. It happened earlier as well, but he was able to shield Pennsylvania. The Massachusetts charter is called in the 1680s. But he's able to shield his colony, and he thinks that if he could get back there in himself and do his own sort of personal politicking and lobbying and networking, he can stop that. As he looks at it, he has invested an enormous amount of money over the last 20 years in this place, and simply taking it away from him would be sort of a violation of his property. So that's the sort of the short-term reason. The colonists understand that he is desperate to get back there, and they sort of extort from him in some ways a new governing document. So once he gets back there, he is able, he and other people as well, the movement to centralize Pennsylvania and the other colonies doesn't go anywhere. But again, he's back to England. He's got a growing young family. His wife was willing to go to Pennsylvania. Hannah was willing to go for the visit, but she's not particularly eager to go back. Her parents are aging, and they're in Bristol, England. And so he really does kind of, in some ways, I think, settle back into the most familiar, comfortable existence. He's English by birth. He's English by being raised. And with a few exceptions, he's been in England, all of his life. So, and then, of course, as we get his financial condition, which is never great, is continuing to get worse and worse. He has a habit of not signing or not reading papers carefully before he signs them. He has a habit of borrowing money from one person to pay back someone else. And so an accumulation of gradually accumulating sort of physical ills. And so, he never, after 1701, after leaving in 1701, never returns.
It was that contrast that I thought was one of the interesting, and it's something that I thought that describing his imprisonment in 1708 made clear, is that you have him he's no stranger to prison. and you have him in the 1670s, going to jail for a few days here and a few weeks there because of issues of conscience and practice. Mm-hmm. And at the end of his life, he's returning back to a condition of confinement. But it's so telling about the problems he faces by the end of his life that it's not because of his beliefs or his writings, but because of the debts he's accumulated over the course of having built this enterprise, which endures in some form down to the present day.
Right. It's a very complicated legal story. I tried to tell it as simply as possible in the book, but he had an assistant, an agent by the name of Philip Ford, who worked for him for decades, and Ford kept all of his accounts and all of that, and Ford would present him with reckonings of his credits and debits, and he would just sort of sign it. And then Ford died in 1702, I want to say, and Ford's widow sort of presented Penn with these papers that he had apparently signed over Pennsylvania as collateral, and money he had borrowed from Ford. Now, no one else knew this. So he tries desperately to keep this private, and he tries to make partial payments and gets away with this for a few years. But then finally, the widow, Bridget Ford, and her son, take Penn to court, and they claim, he claims that he's been swindled by them, and Ford was a fellow, they were all fellow Quakers, so this was, sort of doubly difficult. And eventually he goes into the Fleet Prison for 8 months. It's a humiliation, certainly. It was not so much hard time. I mean, he was able to stay in a room, fairly comfortable, but it's deeply humiliating. And he is absolutely vindictively bitter towards the Ford family, considers himself to have been cheated, and eventually is only able to get out by borrowing the money to pay back the Ford. So it all sort of starts back over again.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. Well, I've got a couple more pen things just sort of in the works. Just the other day, published a book of essays called The Worlds of William Penn with Rutgers Press, which is an edited collection of new sort of scholarship on Penn from a range of different disciplines, art history and literature and political theory and history and so on. And I've got one last project that I'm currently working on, which is a sort of a scholarly edition of Penn's political writings, where it would involve tracking down all of his scriptural references and so on. It's a bit tedious, but it's really quite fascinating to see all the ways in which he drew on this lifetime of experience. But I have to say, too, that having done two books on Penn in the last 3 years and having a couple more still in the sort of final stages, I think I'm about to take a break from big new projects. And I got a few courses to teach, and I'm in the process of moving to a position in the political science department at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond from Rutgers. So I'll be having some new colleagues and some new teaching responsibilities. And I'll take a little breather and see what comes up next.
Sounds like quite an adventure there. Well, Andrew Murphy, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks. You too.